This is Richard Sawinski, Managing Editor of the Missouri Review. This podcast is being produced in conjunction with the announcement of the Missouri Review Audio Competition. I thought it only appropriate to return to the campus of the University of Iowa and talk to the English professor who introduced me to the radio essay, Dr. Jeff Porter. What kind of advice would you give students or anyone out there who wants to do a radio essay?
Well, I guess, first of all, you want to think about what kind of story you're telling. Is it ironic? Is it lyrical? Is it over the top? Is it sad? And then you want to think about how you can use your voice and other sounds and music to convey that narrative in all of its richness.
How do they make a music selection? Is it used to somehow to illustrate the text, or does it serve as some sort of counterpoint as a surprise or something unexpected? Is there any rule of thumb that goes with that?
Well, sounds that illustrate can be awfully irresistible, and they certainly have their place, but they can only go so far, while sounds that provide counterpoint, on the other hand, are a bit more challenging, but will give you, I have a hunch, a bigger bang for the buck. Take the opening music in Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining, those haunting sounds of Wendy Carlos's score, which is based, if I remember right, on the medieval Mass of the Dead. Rather than simply illustrating the narrative action, at this point Jack and Wendy are driving to Colorado. Wendy Carlos' score actually recontextualizes things by counterpointing the idea of a working vacation at a mountain resort. It's kind of weird music and pretty unsettling. It certainly doesn't provide the kind of pastoral soundscape that would fit in at this point in the movie, but it's very effective in taking us elsewhere, as if extending the space of the movie in a new direction. So I think a strategic mix of illustrative and atmospheric sounds are best, as they're likely to produce the most creative results.
What I remember about the radio essay course was how difficult it was to take a written essay, something that I'd already worked on and gone through several versions, and then try to get that down to a length that would still work, that would be interesting. And it was very difficult to go from a longer essay down to something that would, say, last less than 7 minutes.
It's a bit of a shock when you actually have a text in front of you, and it's something that you've labored over for a while, and it's quite writerly. It's stylistically a gem. It's laden with meaning. You know, it's rich. It's complicated. It's intricate, and it's long. You know, we think that the value is somehow attached to length. The reverse, perhaps, is true in alternative media. You know, in writing, more is more. The alternative media, quite often, less is more. To become a good radio artist, I suspect a writer has got to learn how to become elliptical, which is probably not very easy to do. We're paid to fill in the blanks. I suppose when a good writer wants to be a good radio artist, she will let sound carry more of the burden of meaning. And my guess is that this is probably the biggest challenge for writers when crossing over into radio.
I remember in taking your class that until then, I would go up to the coffee shop and it would just be a place to write and study. But after taking your class, you become aware of all the different sounds that are going on, the coffee maker in the background and all these great things, because I was actually thinking about doing a documentary that had to do with the coffee shop. I didn't do it, but there were a lot of interesting sounds going on.
Well, we know that Glenn Gould, the great Canadian pianist and sound artist, recommended a radical idea of the listener based on his belief that the average person probably could take in a far greater amount of information than assumed when listening to popular radio. Gould's ideal was a listener like yourself in a cafe, sitting down and then eavesdropping on three or four conversations running simultaneously. And Gould, of course, was famous for this. And that's perhaps why he was so excited by quadraphony, or four-channel sound, back in the early 70s. And I think that Gould was absolutely right to assume that the complexity of our acoustic world requires a much more expanded, rather than a reductive, kind of listening. And maybe that's why in his famous Solitude Trilogy series of radio documentaries, Gould often has three or four subjects speaking at once, as though he were conducting chamber music or something.
Dog sled trip of 22 days, and the other fellow says, "Well, I did one of 30 days."
No, for another 11 years.
Perhaps they
an audio essayist, are they likely to be young, or is there hope for us geezers? I mean, can we become good at the audio essay or making audio pieces, documentaries, whatever that is.
Well, you know, the current popularity of radio commentary stories and essays was largely driven by middle-aged writers who infiltrated the airwaves way back in the mid to late 80s with their quirky stories and their even more quirky voices. And I'm thinking of Bailey White, Daniel Pinkwater, and the Romanian poet Andrei Cudrescu. Ten years later, Ira Glass, who learned his trade cutting tape in Washington, introduces This American Life in Chicago, which deliberately went after a much younger market, the 30-something crowd. This and the emergence of the iPod generation shortly afterwards does indeed give the impression that radio art is made for and by the young, but that's probably not true.
You mentioned some idiosyncratic voices.
Yeah, personally, I love idiosyncratic voices on the radio. I think idiosyncrasy is a good thing. One thinks of Kim Williams from Missoula, Montana, or Baxter Black from Texas. These were storytellers active in the 80s on the radio. Or Sarah Vowell and David Sedaris today. I suppose what's compelling about these voices is that they're all uncorporated. They seem to be coming from outside of the media. Even though, frankly, you know, they're all distributed by an institutionalized source like National Public Radio, or PRI. But I guess they simply sound homegrown rather than coming out of some large vat.
So you don't have to have a radio voice or broadcaster's voice in order to do this.
My guess is that if you did have a slick broadcaster's voice, that would be to your disadvantage. In fact, I think that the radio essay, the contemporary version of the radio essay, is in part made possible by a large dissatisfaction with the broadcast voice itself, that voice of authority.
Well, part of the challenge includes what you've already talked about is you're reading out loud and you come across these rough spots that you think, you know, are so great. You've got this wonderful cumulative sentence, but it just doesn't work when you voice it. But yeah, and, you know, there's all these choices that a writer makes with the words, the sentence structure. But then when you add sound to it, it just multiplies those choices almost beyond believability. I mean, then it's almost like too many choices. What do you do next? What kind? I struggle with the music bed. What kind of music? What should I pick? The pausing there's just I almost feel like one should be a musician, or if one were a musician that you're better suited for this type of work, and I'm not that. So there is a just educating yourself about the different sound choices and what works, and for me it became a trial and error sort of thing.
Arguably, that's probably the wisest way to approach radio art, especially in the age of digital editing, if only because it's now possible to experiment with multiple choices on the same timeline by cutting and pasting. In fact, it's foolish not to play out alternative options when tinkering around with sound design. And who knows, maybe this is why we should really look at editing programs as kind of learning environments. Well, let me give you an example of thinking through your sound choices by trial and error. This is from a project by a friend, Alfredo Lujan, who wanted help making his first radio essay. Alfredo lives in New Mexico and wrote this lovely story about revisiting an arroyo he witnessed as a kid repeatedly fill up with water during heavy downpours. And so he wanted to turn this into a radio story, and I said, sure, it's a great idea. Once Alfredo recorded his story, and it sounded pretty good, we began thinking about what kind of sounds and music we might use to build the sound space for the whole piece. As far as natural sounds went, that was easy to think out. On a daily basis, there's rain and thunder in New Mexico, so we recorded that. The trick was trying to decide the right kind of music to lay underneath the narrative. I thought I was really clever when I suggested that we use bolero. I guess I was having an Ira Glass moment. I think we were both hoping that bolero, because of its famous crescendo, would express something about the nature of an arroyo. So we grabbed the bolero track from Ravel, dragged it beneath Alfredo's narrative, repositioned things, got the mix right, then hit the spacebar for playback and listened in. And of course it sounded awful. It just didn't jive with Alfredo's voicing of his story, and that was a real problem. Alfredo had this peculiar rhythm to his story that was absolutely out of sync with the relentless tempo of Bolero. And that was a bummer. So we switched genres, laid down some straight-ahead jazz, recorded some environmental sounds, and that seemed to do the trick.
It rained last night, but the southwestern sun has baked the ground. It's arid again. Thunder rolls vaguely in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains behind us, New Mexico style. No clouds or lightning visible. My 14-year-old daughter Amanda and I are at the swimming pool. She's sunbathing, I'm in the shade. Sunbathing has never been a thing for me. The only rays I've ever taken in have come from working in the sun, as a laborer, a dump truck driver, a post hole digger, a summer recreation director, an administrative assistant, a gopher. During the summer, I've always had what sunbathing aficionados call a farmer's tan. It ain't a compliment. The farmer's tan line begins with a short sleeve and the collar end. It comes from toil, a working class tan. It's not oiled or golden or olive, nope. This tan goes layers into the subcutaneous tissue. It takes generations and generations to perfect. It runs in the DNA. Am I dark? Maybe I was born dark. Amanda and I return to apartment Alegria. She goes straight for the computer. I pour her a glass of ice water and get a tecate and a sipper of Patron for myself. I go out to our patio, sit on one of the green chairs under the portal, sip on my brew and agave, read more, and watch the storm come in. Listen to the storm come in. Typical northern New Mexico deluge. You can see the sheet of rainfall 30 miles away being pushed towards you on its tiptoes on the wind on the horizon. Even though it's sunny, a terremoto comes swishing through, picking up more dust and sand particles, spitting them in all directions, stinging my skin, leaving earth residue on my book. It's followed by a few drops of rain.
This question is a summary, perhaps, of much of what you've already said. But if you were judging an audio competition, what would you be looking for? What do you pay attention to? What makes a good audio piece?
Well, first and foremost, you need a good text. There's simply no way of getting around it. Great writing is a necessary point of departure for great radio art. And then comes the performative stage. Placing your writing on the air means getting your text past the sound barrier, and that probably means finding the right voicing for your story, which is a bit like acting it out in front of a microphone, and that's always a wee bit unsettling, but it's something you just have to get by. And last but not least, there's sound design, building an expressive soundscape that evokes meaning in your text that might otherwise get overlooked. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. A strong text, the right voicing, and an expressive soundscape. And you bring these three things together and you're going to have knockout radio art.
Discussed a range of ontological improvements
the Missouri Review of First Larry Imagination, and featured on the nation's